Hello and welcome to Warships Pod. And in this episode, I have Dr. Robert Farley with me again. Not long after we, in fact, talked about the Ukraine war and various other things before, but there have been some dramatic developments at sea, most of all the loss of the Russian guided missile cruiser Moskva. So welcome back, Rob.
It's a delight to be back here, Ian.
So what do we know about the Moskva, do you think, at this stage? It's several days since the event happened and the fog of war does still swirl around. So in general, what do you think we know actually happened out there?
Well, I mean, at this point, it's really remarkable the extent to which we don't know what happened, right? We still have contending narratives with respect to what happened to this vessel. To my understanding, the first report we had was from Ukrainian state sources, essentially celebrating the fact that they had struck the Moskva with two Neptune surface-to-surface anti-ship missiles. There was talk that it had been distracted, the crew had been distracted by a TB2 unmanned aerial vehicle, and so wasn't really paying attention to the missiles. And then there was just a flurry of different kinds of reports about what was happening to the ship. I mean, it became clear that the ship had not immediately been sunk, but then we started hearing reports that a Turkish vessel had picked up some of the crew, and then the Russians essentially said the ship was lost in a storm. And now we're seeing all sorts of interesting photographs, some of which have clearly been faked, but others of which most definitely look plausible and definitely indicate a ship in really severe distress, on fire, smoke, listing, and so forth. So it's really a remarkable event as part of this war that the Ukrainians have managed, to sink this vessel in some way.
Right. I mean, I'm not some of the sources I have are not even now 100% certain that it was the Ukrainians that hit the vessel with a missile, and that it could well have been because of the previous incident in the Black Sea with the landing ship Saratov, which blew up due to mishandling of ammunition that was being transferred to other vessels. So it is likely, I suppose, that the Ukrainians managed to do something to bring about the demise of the ship. But it's still, even in a war with an amazing amount of video and other things online, almost instantly of episodes, it was an object lesson in how the sea, what lies beyond the horizon, or just beyond the horizon, just below it, can be still somewhat mysterious. And particularly warships, because people are not that familiar with warships in a way that they might pretend to be or actually be experts on tanks and armies. So I don't know. I mean, I'm still in two minds on it. I think it could be that the Ukrainians hit the vessel, and it could also be that traditional Russian incompetence, shall we say, in certain areas of handling ammunition, etc., could have done it. And I guess the thing that we can be 100% certain of, because we've now seen those photographs that you mentioned and even a short video clip, is that the vessel was lost. And even that, even those photographs and the video revealed that it wasn't lost in a storm. So, I mean, even that was changed just yesterday when we saw that. So if we look at the vessel herself and her history, she was created in the late 1970s and basically hasn't done an awful lot in terms of action at all, although one person on the web referred to her as battle-hardened, but I don't think that has ever happened. More like experienced and long in the tooth. So do you think this was a mistake, putting an old vessel with not necessarily up-to-date defences and sensors that close, although she wasn't that close, in fact, to the Ukrainian coast, if we go with the missile hit theory?
Right. Well, so I want to back up a second. I'm curious your thoughts on this. You know, one of the indications, and I know that we don't have sort of conclusive evidence, but I mean, the fact that the Ukrainians announced this before the Russians admitted it, it would sort of require the Ukrainians to have had eyes on the ship and to have noted the fire or other sort of catastrophic event on board the ship, and then taken credit for that. And that's entirely possible. But sort of the ordering of events and the ordering of the announcement makes it seem more likely that the Ukrainians did in fact bring about the destruction of the vessel. But I suppose we'll find out more about this as more information comes in, hopefully in the future.
Yeah, you're right there. I mean, one of the images that stuck in my mind when I saw those of the Moskva was HMS Sheffield burning after Exocet missile hit in 1982 in May of that year, when Argentine Etendard strike aircraft fired a couple of Exocets, in fact, at a target. And they came in low, then they popped up, did a quick radar search, and then fired the missiles at something they thought would be a warship in the vicinity of where the British task group was off the Falkland Islands. And then the missile did the rest. And I've actually interviewed people who were aboard Sheffield, and one of them saw the missile coming in, and it looked like a spinning disc because it was just above the sea, so it was probably whipping up moisture or sea, and it was swirling around. And they had no time to react to that, and it was straight in. So if you look at that event in 1982, which was around the time the Mosfet was joining the fleet, I mean, HMS Sheffield was sunk, and all the Type 42 destroyers that the Royal Navy's got of that era are long gone. So in these episodes, and this comes back to this idea of, you know, did the Ukrainians see it and capitalize on it, or did they actually detect the vessel and then fire a definitive target, or did they just fire something that they hoped would hit? I mean, it's a lot of mysteries, a lot of things we don't know. We're just landlubbers. So did they see the fire and capitalize on it? Possibly. Could they actually see something on a radar screen, a guidance radar, and then just sent off something in the hope it would strike a big target? Yeah, that could have happened as well. So I think the jury's out a little bit. But the US Department of Defense, one of the officials there, has said that he or she thinks that this was indeed two missiles that took the Mosfet out. Have you seen that?
Yeah, I've seen that. I've seen that. And the DoD always talks in terms of confidence levels. And so this was, they did not make a certain judgment, but I think that they had some degree of confidence that this was missile strikes. So to go back to the previous question you were thinking of, right? So what is the utility of this very large warship out in the Black Sea? And it's interesting that sort of just prior to the war, the Russians had her and her two sisters in the Mediterranean. She joined up with her two sisters, both of whom, as my understanding is, are slightly more modern than she is. They've gone through a sort of a more significant modernization project. And they were out there essentially trying to intimidate NATO vessels. And when we're saying she here, I think a lot of Russian sources are actually saying he, because they often refer to their vessels as he, but we should maintain our correct English assessment of the gender of these warships. I mean, it's very interesting, right? Because this was a ship that was involved in the Battle of Snake Island. And in that case, she used her, I believe it's a 130 millimeter gun, which is, of course, a spectacularly large gun by modern maritime standards, right? And then my understanding is that she was operating essentially as a command and control ship. She has an S-300 that was providing some air cover over the southern coast of Ukraine, but perhaps not an extensive amount of air cover. And this was available in open source intelligence. She was essentially simply sailing back and forth in very predictable fashion. And this was something that was available. We were seeing this several days before the strike. People were talking about Moskva sails one point to another point and then sails back, which also I think sort of lends some credence to the fact that the Ukrainians may simply have guessed where she was at a given point and then launched the attack. I mean, it's a tough situation. This is an incredibly valuable symbolically valuable piece of equipment for the Russians, and it did contribute to the fight in some fashion. But the propaganda effect here is just absolutely devastating for the loss of this ship.
Yeah, I think one of the things that you raised there, really directly or indirectly, is the whole concept of what the Russians do with their navy. Because although during the Gorshkov era, you know, the Cold War era, when Admiral Gorshkov sent out hundreds of ships at a time on the high seas to establish a massive presence and try and counter what NATO is doing, and in fact overawe NATO. Since the end of the Cold War, the Russian Navy and a ship like Mosfet is very much an example of this. It's about show and waving the big stick and what you might call guided missile diplomacy, fire off a few missiles into Syria and also show a big ship somewhere to win friends, terrify people in the Baltic, or, you know, get influence somewhere like the Eastern Mediterranean. And I think that the Russians have now learned the difference between a show navy and a combat navy. And of course, they've had very little opposition when they've fired missiles. In fact, no opposition when they fired missiles into Syria. And in fact, they've not conducted any what you would call conventional naval operations against any kind of foe for many decades. And it sort of reminds me again, and in this 40th anniversary year of that conflict, quite appropriate, of HMS Glamorgan, which was a British guided missile destroyer of her kind, quite elderly, but still useful in 1982 to bombard Argentine positions, and with other vessels was going in and out of waters just off Port Stanley, the capital of the Falkland Islands, to regularly bombard the Argentine troops ashore to try and break their morale, to try and hit things. And I know this because I spoke to a few people aboard after the war, including the navigator. One day at the end of the war, when she was coming back from a naval gunfire support mission, the same kind of mission that Moskva was doing against Odessa, using those big guns you mentioned, and unfortunately just clipped what they call the sort of box, the danger box, where they might get hit by an Argentine missile if there was one ashore. And although they'd used up their stock of exocets in the air, the Argentinians did in fact have some exocets mounted, I think a bit like this missile the Ukrainians have, in a container on a truck, and saw their opportunity and just wanged one off against this British vessel that got hit in the hangar, and that caused quite a few casualties and was a hell of a mess, but did not destroy the ship. It did not sink the ship. That maybe brings us on to what have we learned when we see that image of Moskva burning and that short video clip. So do we get any nearer knowing A, what she was hit with, and B, or whether it was an internal explosion, and C, what the Russians did to try and save the vessel? What, have you discerned anything from looking at that imagery at all, Rob?
I have not. One of the things that's interesting about the imagery is that, you could correct me if I'm wrong about this, but I mean, we don't see any indication that the crew is still on board while the ship is burning. So we don't see them scurrying about and fighting fires on the external. And so, I mean, it looks to me like some portion, and this is another thing we don't know. We don't know how much of the crew survived even the rescue. I mean, there was a parade afterwards, and you know, there was a question of like, did this happen before? Did this happen after? I think a Turkish ship reported picking up some 50 of the crew. I think we do know that the crew, what part of the crew abandoned the ship, abandoned it well before the ship sank. So the ship was essentially uncrewed for some amount of time before it, after it was damaged and before it was sunk. But that's one of the things that's striking about me about the photographs and the video is that there doesn't seem to be anything happening in terms of damage control on the vessel. And another thing we don't know here, and it's been brought up, is the Russians may well not have been at general quarters, right? They may not have expected this attack, and so they may not have made the ship watertight or done any of the other sorts of things that they need to do. I've seen one report too, which suggested that they did not have a single centralized firefighting system, that this was something that's actually been installed in the two sisters of Moskva during their modernization, but for reasons of funding, it was not installed on Moskva. And so there was, in some sense, no way for centralized authorities to know where the fire was or how to direct resources towards fighting the fire. And this is World War II stuff from the British or American point of view, right? This is stuff that you need to have solved in 1941. That the Russians are still sort of struggling to make this happen indicates that their damage control is really quite problematic. But, you know, we can say the same thing of the Kuznetsov and of other ships that they've operated that have had accidents.
Yeah. I mean, damage control, how to handle such things is something that warships train for continuously, whether they're preparing for a deployment or actually on deployment. So it's something that goes on all the time, whether it's a surface warship or a submarine. And I've seen numerous damage control exercises at sea and also at a place called Flag Officer Sea Training or Fleet Operational Sea Training in Devonport, where NATO navies and sometimes American ships too, it's normally European NATO navies, I should add, and American warships when they visit, are put through grueling procedures in how to tackle fires, how to seal them off, how to deal with incoming missiles. I mean, they have a thing called a Thursday War where they're continuously attacked by various mock enemies, mock foes, and are told to look out for fast boats or simulating or things simulating fast boats. So it has to be trained for continuously, and that's a professional navy. And also vessels, American vessels learning from their experience with World War II, and also, I guess, in the tanker war with the loss of one or two vessels there, and the Royal Navy in the Falklands War, that you need to fight the fire, be ready to counter any flooding, and put into practice your damage control straight away. And with the, you mentioned that thing about it doesn't appear to be anybody visible, but with the Sheffield, for example, that vessel had the water mains cut, as did others, I believe, that were hit by the Argentinians during the war. And also the coating of the wires, electrical wires, etc., was actually poisonous. It gave off poisonous fumes and great amounts of smoke. So they were driven, the crew of that warship were driven out of the internal spaces, and were on the flight deck, because we see nobody on the flight deck of the Moskva, and they were also on the forecastle. We can't see the forecastle of the Moskva in the image. So it seems that they were swiftly driven out, and probably people did make an attempt to fight whatever the damage was, whatever raging fires were going on, but they were probably swiftly overwhelmed. And as you say, we don't really know what happened to the crew. One theory about the missile, and this is something that I know one of the magazine's contributors, a guy called Tony Roper, has put out there on his blog, is that they may have reacted to the incoming missile or missiles, if that's what happened, with their close-in weapon system, sort of Gatling gun that fires out lots of shells, a wall of steel, a curtain of steel, and that they may have hit one or two missiles, but that the missiles fragmented, blew up, and the wreckage from those incoming missiles is actually what penetrated the Moskva, set off the fires and ammunition and whatever. So it could be, who knows, if we ever have a public inquiry from the Russians, probably unlikely, that's what happened. But generally, looking beyond the specifics of the Moskva, as somebody who specialises in strategy and, so we say, the bigger picture of wars and things surrounding them in your day job, what impact do you think in general that the loss of the Moskva has had on the conduct of the war, or on the Russians themselves?
Well, I think there are some reports, and again, you know, we're dealing with a complete lack of information because of the opacity of the Russian state. There are reports that the rest of the Black Sea Fleet has essentially scrammed from sort of close range from the Ukrainian coast, right? And we already pretty much knew that the their amphibious warships were not going to be able to successfully launch an amphibious assault on Odessa or anywhere else, right? That the Ukrainians simply had that locked down. But I think it's definitely nice from the Ukrainian point of view to feel, you know, essentially completely secure from a Russian amphibious attack. But again, that's probably an indication that the Russians believe that the ship was hit by a missile. And so, you know, really in the end, the strategic implications of this, and I think we're seeing this today, really, aren't going to be all that substantial, right? The symbolic and the political implications of this are huge, but the Russians can continue to, conduct a long range blockade of Russian port or of Ukrainian ports. The Ukrainians still aren't able to import or export anything. They aren't able to take advantage, by seizing control of the sea. Russia's lines of operation are all internal. They're all on land. And so, you know, just this morning, we're starting to see the substantial Russian offensive in the Donbass that we've been expecting for a while. And so, you know, this is certainly a victory for Ukraine, but it's by no means a decisive victory in the sense that it's going to change Russia's mind about what Russia wants to do, or that it's going to really substantially detract from Russian capabilities. You know, the Russian Navy here was showboating in a lot of ways in the Black Sea. And from an organizational perspective, that completely makes sense. And they've paid the price for showboating. But you know, much like the airborne forces in the early days of the war, which were completely wiped out in very ill-considered operations at Hostomel Airport and other places, you know, the Russians really have a taste here of what high-intensity warfare looks like and how dangerous it is. But it doesn't seem it's going to change Russia's basic approach to the war.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, there are warships, newer warships, more capable warships in the Black Sea Fleet, the frigates, and also there are submarines there. six altogether improved Kilo class submarines that are armed with caliber cruise missiles, and there are even corvettes armed with caliber missiles as well as the frigates. So it doesn't actually change the balance at sea in terms of what they can do to launch missiles inland and maybe enforce a distant blockade, but certainly it's made them think twice about their parade off Odessa or anywhere else, and that was a salutary lesson for them. And I think part of the problem with the Russian Navy is that if you think back to its history, during the Second World War, it was an adjunct to the Red Army, and it wasn't a ocean-going force like it tried to be in the latter stages of the Cold War. And also, as we know, before that, the Russians sent an entire motley collection of battleships and cruisers round, all the way from the Baltic round to waters off Japan, where it got absolutely battered by the Japanese, who probably in a few decades got a greater grasp of what it means to be a true maritime power than the Russians do. But that's inevitable because Russia is such a massive landmass. So again, I suppose what we're seeing is the Russian Navy being exposed for what it is, a support arm for the army. Although, of course, we still have the Russian strategic missile forces at sea in the high north in the Arctic. So we should never discount them and never underestimate them. So do you see, more generally, do you see the Ukraine war intensifying now for a matter of weeks and then dying away if they secure the Donbass, or will it drag on, do you think? Are we anywhere nearer seeing what the arc of this war is going to be?
I don't know. And I say that, I think at the beginning of the war, I was willing to tell people that this war might well last longer than folks expected. And this was back when we were expecting the potential for a siege of Kiev and other operations that felt like they were going to take a really long time. Now, as it happens, Kiev has never been besieged, right? The Russians have never been able to establish a siege of either Kharkiv or Kiev. And so, you know, sort of the Ukrainian performance has been so much stronger. I mean, I think right now, taking a look at what's happening in the Donbass, it's really anybody's guess as to how capable the Russian army remains. You know, they've certainly been doing the right things in terms of carefully dealing with their logistics, setting up secure lines of supply, not engaging in sort of spectacular thunder runs that then completely fall apart or are torn apart by the Ukrainians. But there are also some indications that the Ukrainians have launched sort of counteroffensives that are designed to unbalance the Russian approach. And so right now the situation on land seems to me to be very fluid in terms of whether, I mean, if you look at a map of the Donbass, it doesn't look great for the Ukrainians because they do have a pocket of some of their most effective forces that look like they really could be encircled if the Russians are aggressive. And we don't yet have a good account of Ukrainian military thinking about why they are leaving some of their forces in a potential situation of encirclement. And we may have a lot to critique about how they are approaching this battle in the future if they lose it. But, you know, at this point, they have fought, you know, the morale of Ukrainian forces is substantially higher. They have become a more capitalized force as the Russians have become less capitalized, in terms of equipment over the past month and a half. And so while I think that, you know, the inclination is still to think that just the weight of Russian power is going to help them overwhelm the Donbass, that it's possible that they're not going to be able to. I mean, what I don't see at this point is the Russians successfully pursuing a war for the rest of Ukraine. I think that if they manage to secure the Donbass, then I'm not sure they would be able to attack the rest of Ukraine. But I very much doubt that they have the appetite for it after the losses they've suffered so far.
As well as being an object lesson for them at sea, the loss of the Moskva, I think you're right, there's been an amount of pain for them on land. But overall, I think it's just the Russian way of doing things. I think in terms of their army, I think they'll carry on piling on the firepower, pouring in the troops until they get something by May the 9th, the celebration of victory in the Great Patriotic War enables President Putin to announce from wherever he's reviewing the great parade in Red Square from the Kremlin that they've achieved a victory and achieved their war aim. Although, of course, that won't be the end of the story even then. And one thing that is a legacy, perhaps, of the Moskva sinking, which people have talked about, is the broken arrow, whether or not there's a broken arrow there. So what we mean by that is a nuclear weapon on board. So I think what people are talking about really are weapons that Russian warships and Russian submarines have quite generally that are twin use, that can either be nuclear tipped or conventionally tipped. So whether or not Moskva has any actual nuclear warheads on any weapons aboard, I wouldn't know. But generally, the Russian military has this kind of dual use doctrine. And in the Kaliningrad enclave, there are potentially nuclear tipped missiles already that could threaten the Baltic, can threaten Europe, could probably hit most of us. So, and they're regularly at sea in surface vessels. So have you heard anything about whether or not there might be any nukes on board the Moskva?
So what I've heard that is that it's a very interesting question, right? That at times in their history, the Slava-class cruisers have carried three kinds of nuclear weapons. And I don't know the technical designation of each of these, but basically three nuclear weapons designed to do three things, right? So on the one hand would be anti-ship surface missiles with nuclear tips, which was fairly standard in a lot of Russian ships during the Cold War, intended to kill carriers, and anti-submarine warheads that were designed to. I mean, this is a multi-purpose ship. It's specialized for anti-surface attack, but it's a multi-purpose ship, and also anti-air nuclear weapons, which were designed for air defense. Now, a lot of people were talking about a broken arrow immediately after the ship sank, and I don't think that there has been anything that would point to any level of confidence right now that this ship was actually carrying nuclear weapons at the time. It is interesting that back at the very end of the Cold War, although I suppose now we can talk about whether the Cold War ever ended. now that we're in the middle of another one. This particular cruiser was used for some tests, with respect to, whether, so essentially American, helicopters would, with Russian permission, would buzz the ship, seeing if they could detect nuclear weapons on board, the vessel, which was then intended essentially, you know, these are confidence building measures on both sides, right? So if the Russians say there are no nukes and then we fly something near it, then we know, and then they can do the same thing with ours. And so that builds confidence, arms control for tactical weapons on both sides. And to my understanding, Slava was the test bed for some of these examinations. That's awfully interesting. I would be very surprised to learn that the Russians had loaded, any kind of nuclear device onto this ship, especially because what are you going to use it for? Right. I mean, the Ukrainians don't have any submarines. So why would you have the nuclear depth charges? I suppose they do have aircraft. So why, that's fine. But the surface to surface missiles on Moskva could not strike land targets, right? These were missiles that were optimized for attacking enemy ships, of which the Ukrainians now have none. So just because there's no good reason doesn't mean the Russians don't do a thing. But I would be really surprised to learn that there were nuclear weapons on board this ship.
And it's very interesting, Rob, that you mention how we might wonder if the Cold War ever ended. And I think you're right in a way. I don't think the Russians in their own minds were satisfied with the end of it, and increasingly so as the years went by after, 1991. And they have been waging or conducting a form of Cold War with us certainly since 2014. And in terms of maritime affairs, there have been senior UK and American commanders for several years saying that already there's a contest at sea, and in fact forecasting a fourth Battle of the Atlantic coming along, because the first one was obviously during the First World War, U-boats versus Britain and the Allies in America. And then the Second World War was the Second Battle of the Atlantic. And then the Third Battle of the Atlantic was the Cold War itself. And so there's a fourth already underway. And I'm not sure how much of a contest it would be in in terms of what we might understand from Second World War or the First World War or the Cold War. I'm not sure how it would unfold. I think a future Battle of the Atlantic, if there was one, would unfold completely differently. Have you any thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, I think, and this is, I know a lot of naval authorities in the United States have been thinking about this, that in a lot of ways, you know, there have been some changes in technology with respect to submarine and anti-submarine warfare since 1991. But perhaps what's almost a larger issue is that a lot of the muscles that NATO forces developed over the years of the Cold War, in anticipation of hunting Russian submarines, not only in the Atlantic, but also in the Arctic, a lot of those muscles have atrophied, right? That navies have been doing different things for the past 30 years, right? Often in support of land forces, in support of operations in the littoral and so forth. And that the concentration has not been on high intensity combat. It has not been on sort of waging an offensive or a defensive anti-submarine warfare. Anti-submarine warfare is about a lot more than just the weapons that you have available to you, right? It's about an extensive degree of coordination between platforms where there is sort of real-time information sharing. And this has been the case since 1942. I mean, arguably, it's been the case since 1917, but it's certainly been the case since World War II, when you're sort of integrating air, sea, and undersea platforms, and that requires a tremendous amount of work and coordination. And you know, if we really are looking at a situation in which we anticipate Russian vessels operating in a threatening manner in the Atlantic, those are really muscles that need to be built up, right? They need to be built up on both sides of the Atlantic. I mean, the British, the French, the Americans. This may inform what we anticipate to be German naval, Germany's reconstruction of its naval forces, but may also inform things like what the Italians and Spaniards do with their aircraft carriers, right? Which have been very much focused on strike. And strike is important, but we should also now be thinking about, well, instead of F-35Bs, maybe these small carriers should sort of return to their original purpose, which is the anti-submarine warfare, or should be diverted in that direction. Because, you know, and I think we can return to this, and I do want to talk a little bit about the construction of Moskva, because, of course, she was built in Ukraine, right?
Yes, yes.
But, you know, the one thing that the Russians are still good at in terms of naval construction is submarines. Right. It's the last thing that the Russian defense industrial base can do in terms of maritime power is build submarines and build relatively effective nuclear and conventional submarines. It's the competency that they have not lost. And so if we look at the future of naval competition with Russia, it is very much undersea competition.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, that's very true. And it's interesting you mentioned that Moskva was built at, in the Cold War days, Nikolaev, the yard that built all three Slava-class guided missile cruisers. Today's called Mykolaiv, and the Russians are exerting themselves to possess Mykolaiv. And that's one of the, and it'll be interesting just to hear your views on this. That's one of the things that perhaps is overlooked when people try and understand Vladimir Putin's motivation, is that a lot of it is strategic and industrial and economic. And that when they annexed Crimea in 2014, one of the things that was poleaxed was their production of frigates, because they no longer could just buy in the engines for the new frigates, the first generation new frigates they were building. They couldn't buy them anymore. They were denied them because they were made in Ukraine. And of course, if they get a hold of Mykolaiv, and they get a hold of all these ports on the Sea of Azov and extend their occupation and sovereignty further to the west, then they will possess a lot of the industrial might that the Soviet Union had to churn out naval capability, warships, military capability. So do you think that actually what motivates Putin, apart from this spiritual idea of uniting all the Slavic peoples and everybody who is in Ukraine is really a Russian, there is the cold, hard logic of military industrial capability to take on the West at some future date?
I think that's certainly one of the things that's motivating him. And by the way, to my understanding, there remains a fourth Slava incomplete that has been incomplete since the 1980s.
Oh, right.
In Mykolaiv.
I forgot about that one.
That periodically the Ukrainians talked about selling to, and I think they may have even had a scheme to sell it to China at some point. But, you know, I think what the Russians are going to discover, and, you know, they have, I think that this was definitely part of Putin's thinking, that sort of reintegrating Ukrainian industry. And we think of Ukraine as this massive grain, and certainly it is an incredibly productive grain producer, but it also was very important in terms of defense production. And he may have thought that, you know, this whole, the house of cards through the Ukrainian government was going to collapse and you could bring all this back into the Russian orbit. Since that failed, they have simply been attacking the defense industrial base. And so that's been the true with the MiG-29 factories and with other industrial components. But, you know, this is something, again, that the West learned during World War II, right? That, you know, you can take Mykolaiv and you can reintegrate it into the Russian Federation if you want. But the actual source of industrial capacity in the defense industrial base is not in the MiG-29 factory that you can blast the roof off of. It is in the workforce and the bureaucracy and the firm and the expert producers. So unless you can capture all the shipyard workers and make them work for you in Mykolaiv, it doesn't help just to have the facilities, right? The Russians have facilities in other places, but they don't have a workforce because the workforce all retired or died in that 30-year interregnum when Russia wasn't building ships. And so, you know, unless you – and then that's probably true of the Ukrainians by this point as well in terms of shipbuilding. But the actual facilities, you know, they're important, but they're not the most important part of the defense industrial base. And so I think this is another area where Putin may have just dreadfully miscalculated with respect to what he was trying to grab during this war.
Yeah, I think that lesson of muscles going to waste, shipbuilding muscles, whatever you want to call them, the people, the structure, how to run it, as something that has also gone to seed, gone to waste in the West as well. You know, the UK's warship building yards have withered away and come down. I know there are efforts on to expand them and build it up, but it's going to take years before anything comes back to the level it was even at the end of the Cold War. And I'm pretty sure it's probably the same in the USA because there's only a few yards in America that can take on carriers or submarines, isn't there? There's only a few. So
The United States can only build one carrier at a time, right? Which is something that a lot of defense analysis in the United States, when we say, oh, let's build more carriers, well, how, right? I mean, we would need to come up with, we would need to regrow capabilities that we gave up decades ago. So,
and it's a huge amount of money, and it's difficult on the heels of a pandemic and with other pressing needs such as healthcare or social welfare or whatever for democracies to justify the spending on arms. But the Ukraine war, this explosion in central, rather Eastern Europe, has showed that the things that we feared about Putin's Russia are actually coming true. But turning to one of our favourite topics, which is naval history, the Black Sea, it seems to me from the small amount of writing I've done on aspects of it, let's say trying to operate submarines in there, First World War, Second World War, the difficulties, and looking at today's in and out of warships and what you can and can't do in there, it seems to be a very difficult place, a very closed environment that navies struggle to operate in if they're not actually natives of that area. And obviously, people have contested it for centuries. So do you think that the Mosfa sinking and what's going on there will elevate people's interests actually in Black Sea naval history at all?
Once you study anything about the history of the Black Sea in either of the World War I or World War II, it's intensely interesting stuff that touches on politics and industrial capability. So you mentioned earlier about the Russians sailing ships around the world to find themselves destroyed by the Japanese at Tsushima. You know, the Sultan would not allow the Black Sea fleet to leave the Black Sea in the same way that the Turkish government is not allowing the other two Slava cruisers to enter. And that the five battleships of the Russian Black Sea fleet sparred over the course of 3 years almost continuously with the Turkish fleet, which was led by the German battlecruiser Goeben, which the Turks renamed. And so
this
there were
World
numerous battles. This is in World War One, where there were numerous battles where Goeben would essentially try. There were five pre-dreadnoughts, and Goeben would try to isolate one of them and sink it, just like sort of separating them off from the pack, because the pack was simply too much for Goeben to take. And so there were several battles that were characterized. But at the same time, the Russians were building, I believe, at Sevastopol and possibly at Mykolaiv, they were building three new dreadnought battleships. And eventually those came into service, and that essentially made the Russian fleet dominant in the Black Sea, and Goeben had to sharply curtail our operations. The revolution came along. One of them randomly exploded, as Russian ships do. One of them was scuttled by its crew. But then a third one has, you know, one of the most interesting histories of any battleship ever, and I won't even tell you its name because it had seven names over the course of its history.
Right.
But it was a possession of the Russian imperial government, and then it came into possession of the Germans, who handed it to the first Ukrainian government. So it was operated by Russia, then Germany, then Ukraine. Then the Ukrainians handed it to the British, who then handed it to the White Russians. And so it operated under all of these flags until finally, as the last White Russians evacuated themselves from Crimea, it sailed all the way to Tunis. And it lived out the rest of its 10-year life in Tunis until the French just took it over and offered it back to the Soviets. And the Soviets said, no, it's too rusty at this point. And that's not even the end. At that point, the Finns buy the guns. And so the guns of this warship are operational in the Winter War. And the last of them were still in service like two decades ago. And you can still see some of the guns of this Black Sea battleship in Finland. And so it's an intensely interesting history.
Yeah, I mean, that's extraordinary. Absolutely extraordinary.
Yeah.
They would do that. And I know that it was definitely difficult, very difficult, to get even a U-boat, if you were a German, in both World Wars, into the Black Sea. And they had to go over land and then be reassembled and then sent out to prey on the Russians. And, of course, nobody needs to tell the British about the pain that is caused, associated with the Black Sea, due to the Dardanelles and Gallipoli campaign in the First World War, when Winston Churchill and Admiral Fisher's careers were destroyed by the effort to break through past Constantinople, or Istanbul as it's known today, and relieve the Russian ally of being bottled up in the Black Sea. So you're right, it does have a fascinating history.
Oh, there's one more story that I have to tell that's battleship-oriented with respect to the Black Sea. Three Russian battleships survive in the Baltic. Once the revolution comes, at the beginning, they're named after emperors. Then they're named after communist things. So at one point, the Russians decide, well, we need to send one of these battleships to the Black Sea. And the battleship happens to be named, at this point, Paris Commune. It sets sail, and then essentially after it passes through the English Channel and begins to flood, because this is a Russian Navy ship, and this is what they do. So it essentially lands at Brest, and the Russians refuse to let the French help, and so they try to repair it themselves in Brest. Then they go out again, and it begins to flood again. So then they have to return to Brest. And at this point, they accept the assistance of the French technicians. And so you have these French who are working on this ship named Paris Commune that the Russians have. They finally sail it all the way around, and they rename it the Sevastopol, and it serves in World War II, and it serves with distinction in World War II as essentially the largest surface unit in the Black Sea from a combatant in World War II. But it's another just fascinating tidbit from Russia's naval history of futility, of which the Moskva is only the latest, chapter.
Yeah. Unfortunately, and it's the same with the Kursk, the Russian submarine sank in the Barents Sea in the year 2000, when the weapons in the forward stowage compartment, the torpedo room, if you like, blew up due to not being maintained properly, we think, being run incompetently, maybe. But either way, it was a submarine that had been sent out on an exercise to fire weapons, and they hadn't really done all their proper maintenance, and the training was probably defective as well. So the Kursk is a famous latter-day battleship, an undersea battleship that was blown up in the Barents Sea, although some of the crew were trapped for a while, but the Russians had no rescue equipment. And you talk about denying or help or refusing help. They refused help to rescue those sailors, submariners, if possible. It may not have been possible, from the wreck of the Kursk on the bottom of the Barents Sea. And so those guys expired as well. And then, you know, coming forward, we now have 22 years later, the latter day Kursk, if you like, the Mosva, where again, questions are being asked by mothers, wives, fathers, what's happened to the sailors that were aboard the ship? Because I think that's the great tragedy and a common theme here in Putin's Russia is this lack of clarity or honesty about casualties, or a refusal to do the decent thing and just fess up and admit that, let's say, who knows, 300 or 400 people died, many of them very young conscripts. And so give the families some peace, because that happened with the Kursk too. And people were not given information. And I think that maybe is the final lesson of this, is that when people go to war and it's done in these amazingly sophisticated killing machines, which is what they're meant to be, sometimes it's the people that operate them that end up getting killed, really.
Yeah, and I think I know a lot of Russia analysts and sort of historians of the Putin period talk about the loss of the Kursk as one of his politically most vulnerable moments. That came very close to ending his political career because the Russian popular assessment was just what you said, that he dissembled, he ignored, he refused Western assistance, and those men. Maybe they were unsavable, but it's also possible those men died because he was willing not willing to accept assistance from the Americans, the British, and the French. And that was a very difficult moment for his career as a budding autocrat in Russia.
Yeah, I mean, he did subsequently learn about that for a short period when the Russians lost a mini submarine in the Pacific that was trapped by seabed cables. And Putin did ask for help. Help was rendered very quickly, and it was a British ROV operated by the Royal Navy Submarine Rescue Team, one of several that were there, as well as I think the Japanese, the Americans and others, who were able to cut the cable and release that small vessel and save her crew. But today, I don't think there would be, if there was an incident in the Black Sea, where there was a possibility of, let's say, putting aside enmities between West and East, or between Ukraine and Russia, where lives could be saved with a rescue effort, somehow I don't think that would happen at all. So in wrapping up this episode of the Warships Pod, Rob, and just hooking something on the Mosva, what do you think's the cardinal lesson for us of this episode? Is the one, or are there so many things yet to be unpicked?
I mean, I think the cardinal lesson here for the West, in some ways, I don't think we need this lesson because, you know, the U.S. Navy knew it had to be careful in 1991 and 2003, even though it had overwhelming predominance over the Iraqis. But it knew that the Iraqis had exocets, right? It knew it had to take care. And I think that the cardinal lesson here just sort of kind of backs that up, right? That just because you have overwhelming predominance, you're still going to be a target. And you have to be on your game when you've decided to go and wage a war on somebody. And the Russians simply weren't. They didn't act like this was a serious game.
Yeah, and it doesn't make you wonder if they studied lessons. I mean, you mentioned the Gulf there in 1991, you know, the firing of the Iraqi Silkworm missile, a crude sort of missile, you just point and shoot off the coast, and the British destroyer HMS Gloucester reacts. It's one of several around the American battleship. I think it was the Missouri, I think?
I believe it was the Missouri, yeah.
Yeah, it was. I don't want to get that mixed up with the Wisconsin, which was the other one out there, and reacted very quickly and was able to shoot down to blow up that. In fact, I think fired two missiles, one to target the missile, the other one to target the wreckage, somebody may correct me on that. I should know about it because I've written about it and I know people that were involved. But they acted, you know, instantly to destroy that threat and manage to take it out. And I think people might say that lessons of history are sometimes not relevant and that this is a totally new era and it's all about drones, et cetera, et cetera. But there was a lesson, among others, that the Russians should have studied when it came to taking in key assets very close to a shore and thought, if we do this too often, like you said, as a habit, up and down, then somebody one day may have a pop at us.
Right. I mean, let's just to go back one more time, right? The Turks, a Turkish merchant vessel, picked up survivors from the ship. Just think about what that means for a second, right? It means that there weren't other Russian naval vessels in vicinity of their flagship to pick up survivors from the ship. I mean, that's crazy. That's it. And that's pending what we may later learn. But it's crazy that this ship was operating without a defensive network anyway.
Yeah. But anyway, we'll find out in time, I'm sure. But as usual, it's been a fascinating discussion. Thank you very much. And I appreciate you coming on to chew over this milestone moment in naval history in the Ukraine war with me. Thanks a lot, Rob.
It's always a delight to be here.
Thank you for listening to Warships Pod. For more coverage of the Ukraine war and naval aspects of the conflict, then read Warships International Fleet Review. Throughout most of this year, we've had rolling coverage of events with pictures and analysis and commentary of what has been happening, whether it's Western navies or the Russian Navy. And the loss of the Moskva will be no different to that. And we'll have that in a forthcoming edition. And in the meantime, the latest that we have to offer from our crew of writers is in the May edition, which is out right now.